Hey y'all, it's me, Dr. Smina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm your host, Dr. Smina Rahman. I am a gynecologist board certified with a expertise in sexual medicine and menopause care. I've recently launched my own concierge practice called the GYN and Sexual Medicine Collective in Chicago, Illinois, where I also have license in Indiana and California, so I can see televisits from these areas in Arizona. And I'm super excited. I just announced and revealed the cover of my upcoming book. The manuscript is complete, and I am going to then re-review it one more time, and then it's going to get line reviewed, and then hopefully it'll be published in the next, 3 to 6 months, hopefully less than that. But it is called Brown Girl's Disease: A Guide to Sexual Health and Empowerment Through a South Asian Lens. So I'm very excited about that. And so there's a lot going on. But today, please like and subscribe to my podcast and leave me a review and what you want to hear. Today, my guest is a friend of mine, Jacqueline Jackie Piesta, who is someone I met virtually on Instagram and now I've been seeing and we conferenced together and we're on multiple text threads with a bunch of other menopause clinicians. And so a sub-branch of the menopause, I guess. we are the CLU. Don't ask me what that stands for. Anyway, this is Jacqueline Piesta. She is a Vanderbilt University trained and board certified women's and gender health nurse and has been practicing since 2010. She's certified as a menopause society practitioner by the Menopause Society and an active member of the International Society of the Study of Women's Sexual Health, ISHWISH, the Nurse Practitioners in Women's Health, NPWH, and the American Academy of Nurse Practitioners, as well as Obesity Medicine Association, as well as the Menopause Society. She serves on the Medical Advisory Board for the National Menopause Foundation and serves on the Advocacy and Menopause Summit Planning Committee for NPWH, Educational Committee for the Menopause Society, and the Social Media Committee for ISHWISH. She has revamped the complex curriculum for Vanderbilt University School of Nursing, which is currently taught in the WHNP program, and hosts a clinician mentorship for midlife and menopause care that has trained over 150 clinicians since November 2023. She's a published author and speaks on various medical topics nationwide. So we're going to talk to her today, and we did a great talk about perimenopause. We're diving deep on to this. She's going to bring her clinical perspective in an approachable, evidence-based, and compassionate way. So let's get at it. All right, y'all. So we're diving deep into perimenopausal years today. What's real, what's often dismissed, how we can thrive instead of just survive, whether in your 30s or 40s or beyond. This conversation is for you. And I'm super excited to have my friend and I know Heather calls it menopals now. My menopal, Jackie Piesta here, who is amazing. We met a few years ago virtually and then in real life. So, and she's very outspoken on all the socials, as you saw in my intro on her. And we're going to get right into it. Jackie, welcome to Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones.
Thanks. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for making time for me. I know that you just moved places and, you know, by the time this airs, it's going to be Perimenopause Awareness Month. So I thought, you know, who better to talk about it than, you know, the Peri Princess herself.
That's the first I've ever heard of that, but I kind of love it.
Right? I love anything that gives us royalty. So
I know, right? No, it's certainly... Perimenopause is having a moment right now and I'm all for it. So yeah. Let's go.
It's interesting because I posted recently that I had, I legislation and all the stuff that goes through. So I got something in the mail from our governor of Illinois and it was like,
oh, nice.
Roll. I should have brought it, but I did a reel on it and it was like, hear ye, because X number of women in the Illinois are going through perimenopause and because we don't advocate, we have now declared it in the state of Illinois, September is Perimenopause Awareness Month. And it was from Governor Pritzker. And I was like, oh, I guess like, you know,
That's fantastic. No, I think it's really interesting. One of the, not just to jump right in, but so often one of the the myths I hear. So oftentimes women are told, oh, perimenopause is just a buzzword these days. And I always tell people, I'm like, it's not. Yeah, sure. It's a buzzword. Let's use that to our advantage. It's finally, you know, for the first time in forever, women finally have a vocabulary word to put towards all the things that they've been experiencing through these, you know, mid to late 30s, early to mid 40s and beyond. And, you know, it's a whole, you know, string of symptoms, and we haven't really been able to connect the dots. And so finally this word, perimenopause, oh my gosh, yeah. Could this be it? Yeah. And, you know, there's an argument to say, you know, we don't want to blame everything on perimenopause. We certainly, as clinicians, we want to do our due diligence and make sure that we're not missing anything. But I think it's very empowering for women to finally have that word. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there's still the other side of the coin, which is the fact of the medical gaslighting and saying it's a buzzword. But I think we're going to turn that into a power word and say, yeah, it is a buzzword.
Yes, I agree. Like, I think so many patients come in, you know, late 30s, early 40s, and they're like, I mean, I'm just reading so much. Everything's coming up on my Instagram feed about perimenopause and supplements and this and that. So, like, is everything just perimenopause now? And I'm like, well, yes and no, because we know that, you know, women at this juncture in their life have everything hitting them at once from a stress perspective, you know, pivoting in job, you know, people are getting divorced. People are, like, you know, losing loved ones, people, you know, all these stressful things that we carry the burden of. And then all of a sudden, you know, throw in hormonal flux and it's like a real shit show.
So. Oh, 100%. And most of us are not starting at a good baseline hormonally. You know, either we've been hormonally suppressed for a good, you know, better part of a decade or two decades with birth control pills. And I'm not slighting those. I utilize them in my clinic often. I think they're a fantastic tool. But, you know, we've either lived multiple decades not really knowing what our hormones are, or we, you know, are already in a very stressed state. And so we add more stress to that. And it's not pretty oftentimes. So, you know, that I think that's why we find so many women really looking for those extra layers of support in this time, and really eagerly seeking, you know, answers and validation for this word we say is perimenopause.
Yeah. No, there's a psych term called affect labeling, which once you identify the name of something, your symptoms can automatically feel like either more in control or less, you know, like you can actually, there's some peace in knowing, right? Like even when people come with all these different, you know, they've never been diagnosed with like PGAD or pyramid, whatever. And all of a sudden there's like, this is not just all in my head. Like there's something that can be said about.
Yeah.
And so I always find that it's very empowering for most patients.
Totally.
So tell me a little bit about your journey, Jackie. Like, I mean, obviously I know a lot of it, like tell our listeners a little bit. Journey.
I mean, how far do we want to go back? I feel like I've like grew up in the crib of women's health. My mom is an infertility specialist. And so I grew up, you know, sneaking into infertility labs before that was even like a really common verbiage. People, you know, I was like the weird kid at school that was like, my mom makes test tube babies, when we still called them that. So from a very young age, I really knew that, you know, I loved medicine. I loved like clinical care. I loved taking care of patients. I loved like the science of the infertility lab, but I really needed that human connection, which you don't really get in a lab.
Yeah.
And so I actually, for the longest time, wanted to be a guidance counselor. And then my mom told me that she was like, guidance counselors don't make enough money, so you can't be. And so again, that generation of pressure from the parents. So I wanted to be a psychiatrist. And then somehow I managed to wind myself up into the nurse practitioner profession. I mean, it was mainly off of seeing the nurse practitioners working through my mom's IVF clinics and seeing kind of that role.
Yeah.
And then I always wanted to be an IVF nurse practitioner, but I married an Air Force pilot, and they sent us to small little cities across Texas, and there was never an infertility clinic within, you know, driving distance that I could work at. So sort of as a fallback, I guess I'll say, I went into just regular OB-GYN and practiced for years, you know, gaslighting women through menopause and perimenopause experience. We were never really taught anything.
As we all did, you know.
We had like four slides in a lecture on the Women's Health Initiative trial, and we were scared to death to prescribe anything. And there wasn't a ton of also like support and educational support in prescribing non-hormonal things either. Or maybe I just sort of, you know, steered away from it. Because I also graduated NP school at a very young age. I mean, I was 24 years old. Yeah. I was a baby. And so all that to say, you know, I just sort of fell again. I sort of fell. I was in the right place at the right time. We had moved cities. I was desperate for a job as an NP, and a gynecologist needed somebody to help her manage hormones. And I thought it was crazy. I was like, this is insane. People don't do this. Nobody gives hormones. And sort of the rest is history. I sort of say, like, once you sit down and you really have an authentic discussion about hormones with people who know what they're talking about, it's sort of addictive a little bit. When you start to, like, the clicking the pieces together. So that's it, you know, fast and furious. I've been an NP for 15 years now and always in women's health. And
yeah,
awesome. I love it.
I know sometimes you talk about even, you know, your own journey in this space personally. Like, I don't know how much you want to share and, you know, how, like what kind of symptoms you were, have experienced. And really, you know, we have this whole sort of movement with millennial pause or, you know, millennials going menopause.
Yeah. So I'm definitely your token millennial. I think what we're also starting to hear a little bit more about too is this whole phenomenon of postpartum,
going from postpartum into perimenopause.
Yeah, going from kind of stepping 1 foot into, 1 foot out of the postpartum pool and 1 foot into the perimenopause pool. That might not have been my experience exactly, but I distinctly remember starting to experience night sweating at 36 and mood changes, libido changes. And of course, you know, like we said, there's a lot of other factors there. But there was no reason why I should be having night sweating. I mean, no reason. And I had already had some other things worked up and started on some micronized progesterone, and it was totally life changing for me. I mean, like, the night sweats went away, the sleep, the insomnia went away, the moodiness and a lot of the anxiety throughout the day went away. And I very much believe in a multimodal approach and being very transparent. I mean, I've been on an SSRI, an antidepressant, for many years, and, you know, that, so I knew it wasn't that. I'm like, well, why am I still having this? And so there, you know, that was a couple of years ago now. But I mean, it was the night sweats. I was like, this is out of the blue. What the heck is going on? So again, I think, you know, had I not have been in this space and been a healthcare professional, I probably would have just brushed it off and dealt with it and not known. But, you know, I have the good fortune of this knowledge base and hopefully just advocating for younger women that, like, if you feel like something is off in your body and you really looked into kind of the other reasons why, like, I didn't know I didn't have cancer. That's why I wasn't having night sweats because of that, or diabetes. Yeah. Then let's, you know, what common things happen commonly in perimenopause happens to all women. Well,
So, I mean, I think what's interesting is sometimes, you know, you'll see the patient that's been seen 3 or 4 times or 6 or 7 times, and you know, they're really frustrated because they're younger, and they tell me, like, yeah, you know, my doctor was like, don't worry, you're too young for that. Like, it's like they're trying to tell them that, like, you know, they're trying to give them a compliment, like, no, it's, you're too young for that. And that's, they think what they want to hear, right? Because, like, they're definitely patients, if I start talking about perimenopause in their late 30s, just like, hey, heads up, we give puberty talks, we should give a peritox, this might come for you in the next 10 years. You know, they're like, what are you talking about? I haven't had babies yet, you know? And then other patients who are like, oh, you know, I just wanted validation. And he told me I was too young, or she told me I was too young. And so I think it's a fine balance with some of our patients. But
yeah, I think that, you know, it's that ownership piece, right? And being able to put a name to a face. And it's very, I agree with you, it can be very empowering. At least I found that in my practice. It's not like that for everybody, but I think it's very, very helpful to have a something where you can really tie up those loose ends.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Let's talk a little bit about, like, what are you think, like, the most common symptoms that, you know, you're seeing in your clinical space in perimenopause?
Yeah.
What age ranges are you seeing? You know, let's talk about some of that.
Yeah, I think that's great. So, we've always really leaned on this notion of irregular cycles and then the hot flashes and the night sweats, which still technically, according to the literature, is the most common sort of manifestation of perimenopause, or presentation, should I say. But really, I find oftentimes it's the mood changes, tons of mood changes. Like, I'm just so anxious to drive, like to pick my kid up from school, or, you know, random fears all of a sudden that pop up, or anxiety.
People that can't fly.
Yeah, right. Brain fog is a huge one, like feeling like you have ADD, and maybe we don't, but kind of feeling like that. Can't find names, can't find words, forgetting things. Libido is a big one. I think more women are becoming more forthright and willing to share their challenges in the bedroom. And weight, I see that a lot too. A lot of women complain, I'm not doing anything different and I just keep gaining weight. So I think those are the big ones. I'm probably missing one or two, but sleep is a big one too. A lot of times those are subtle temperature fluctuations and they might not be like a full night sweat.
Right.
Sleep disruptions, mood changes, cognitive brain fog, and weight, I would say, are probably the most common ones I see in the women that cross my path.
Yeah. And I mean, we've talked about this before on this program, but our whatever podcast. Sorry. Let's talk about, you know, the physiology of perimenopause and why it's so complex. I'm sure people have, you know, kind of heard different people talk about the chaos around it.
Sure.
And what happened from, you know, a physiologic perspective. But I always like to review that with the people listening, because maybe they didn't listen to the other ones and they need to know, why is this happening?
Yeah, no, I think it's really important to kind of understand that physiology piece of what's actually going on in your body. So if we're just going to kind of try to at least sum out kind of the hormonal, as far as, I know we're kind of trying to move away from the sex hormone. I'm so like ingrained in me, but our gendered hormones, right? And so our menstrual cycle relies on sort of this perfect orchestra of, you know, the notes and the timing and the instruments coming in when they're meant to come in order to create this beautiful, you know, symphony of what is a normal menstrual cycle and what is typical fertility, right? And so each month we get, you know, the pituitary gland send signal down to the ovary to prepare the uterus and the ovary for potentially ovulation. And then, you know, hormone levels rise to the occasion, we ovulate, and then we either get pregnant or we don't, and the body senses the continuation of the pregnancy hormones, or it senses that those are not there. And so then we have what we know of as our menstrual cycle. And this all is a perfectly, you know, choreographed dance between the brain and the ovaries. And, you know, that's really kind of, simplistic terms. And so as we age and we see the natural decline in the functionality of our ovaries, and then also the health of and the number of eggs and follicles that we have in our ovaries, the ovary becomes less responsive to the signals from the brain. And so we oftentimes don't ovulate. And that's why a lot of women start feeling like progesterone helps them so much, because the main production of progesterone in our body is from ovulation. And oftentimes that's the first hormone to go in perimenopause. And that is also where sort of this slang term estrogen dominance has been born from, as we stop ovulating. So then naturally we become estrogen dominant, because estrogen happens first in the menstrual cycle. And then we don't ovulate. And then when we don't ovulate, we start getting these things called loop cycles. And these are the women that start saying, oh my God, I had a period in 14 days or 12 days or 10 days. And so we sort of get this confusion, but in the uterus doesn't really know what role it plays anymore. Is it there to support pregnancy, or is it there to, you know, have a period? What's going on?
Yeah.
And so really the wires are crossing left and right. And there's our hormones work in more than our ovaries and our uterus. And so I hate to sort of just simplify it down to that, but it is a useful way to look at it when you're really just trying to understand what's happening to your body. Of course, there's other things happening. Those hormones work in our brain. And that's why we see a lot of like the mood changes and the cognitive, the front, like the executive functioning changes and the memory changes. But that's what's happening. And that's why so much of our definition has relied on this notion of the periods, right? So essentially, you're running out of eggs. You don't have any more eggs for fertility. The ovary is saying, cool, like we're not coming to work anymore. And now you're sort of left with this mismatch. So it is a little bit of a roller coaster, or a lot of bit of a roller coaster for women. Just, you know, everybody's different in how they experience it. Some people have very mild symptoms and some people have very, very debilitating symptoms. But it's all about sort of this pattern of hormone timing that sort of gets off.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, rather than saying estrogen dominance, I think most of us like to say that it's, there's like a progesterone deficiency in your 40s that happens. And then, there's like that miss.
Yeah, I don't like the term estrogen dominance, because I find that it puts a negative connotation on estrogen. You know, we don't want to vilify estrogen as such a powerful molecule and hormone in our body. And so when we talk about estrogen dominance, it makes women feel like there's something wrong with estrogen. And there isn't. And so I agree with you. I don't like the term estrogen dominance. I much prefer the term either progesterone deficiency or anovulation, which means we're not ovulating anymore. So anyways, I guess it's potato patata, Samina, but that's the way we like it, right?
Well, I mean, I think the difference in the words that we hear, you know, on social media, because that's what we see from patients. And then they go through and they get all these just testing done that is not, you know, needed, because they think that they have this, you know, estrogen dominance, and they go through this, you know, elaborate, expensive testing that may be offered from, you know, people that then want to give, you know, other therapies that they're selling.
Certainly, 100%. It's a very mixed. Unfortunately, the waters have been muddied up for 20 years.
Quick reality check. If you're listening to this and thinking, why does no one ever talk to me like this in my doctor's office? That's because most doctors aren't trained to, nor do they have the infrastructure for it. That's why I started the GYN and Sexual Medicine Collective, my new concierge practice, where sexual wellness, hormone health, and gynecology actually come together like they're supposed to. No 10-minute visits, no gaslighting, no have a glass of wine, relax. Just evidence-based, shame-free care for women who are done settling for bad sex, brain fog, hot flashes, or feeling invisible. I'm proud to be part of the Ms. Medicine Network, which means your care is rooted in science, not stigma. Find us at www.thegsmcollective.com and book the kind of appointment you wish you had had years ago. Your body called. It wants its power back. Let's go.
Then it's created a lot of stylistic differences.
Well, I always say, I mean, we all talk about how women's health is such a predatory market, because the truth of the matter is, and I've said this many times that, you know, on the podcast, that our medical system is set up to fail women, right? Like, we have these insurance-based models that are really trying to, bottom line, put money into insurance companies and the corporations that hire the professionals that work for them. And at the end of the day, you know, those 50, I know, and I always say, like, you know, gynecologists, unfortunately, get vilified a lot because they're expected to see, you know, I was in a practice at some point where I had to see 30 patients a day. And, you know, that's when we all potentially did some of this, like, unfortunate gaslighting of patients, because A, we didn't learn it. B, we have like 10 minutes for that patient. And I think that it's an unfortunate thing where, you know, I don't even get upset when a patient tells me that she's gone an alternative route, because what are they to do? They're trying to find answers on their own half the time, right? And so I think that, you know, just understanding that, you know, our system is rigged to fail women, and that's why so many of us have to work outside of the system.
100%. It's certainly, and it's something that, you know, we're not taught to be very good about this. So we tend to shy away from things that we're not confident about and that we don't feel good at, and particularly if we don't have the time to focus on that, you know, it's just easier to sort of kind of brush it to the side, whether we're doing that consciously or subconsciously. But yeah, I never want to throw any of my colleagues under the bus. I think we all are very well-meaning individuals. We wouldn't have gotten into medicine in our respective field if we didn't, you know, want to take care of people. And
I mean, most of us are well-meaning.
Most,
yeah.
But medicine is certainly not the glamorous profession that it maybe once was. So it's, you know, most of us are very well-meaning and really want the best and want to try to do our best. But of course, you know, we're human at the end of the day. So we're coming with our own baggage and our own issues. So just is what it is.
Well, I mean, let's talk about even just being an entrepreneur. You and I are both entrepreneurs in our ways that we're trying to do things. Like, how did you decide to navigate this space? Because it does take a lot of intestinal fortitude to move forward with the idea of working outside of a system that you've previously.
Well, I won't lie and say that it wasn't without tears because, we are very much, you know, taught within the system of medicine. And again, like I said, going back, most of us are empaths. We want to take care of people. We were taught and trained that took the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm and to care for all, you know, people as best as you can without bias, without stigma, without any of that. And so, you know, there is, you know, unfortunately, the nature of, you know, being an entrepreneur and trying to start your practice outside of the insurance-based model is you're not going to be able to take care of everyone anymore. And that is something that is difficult to reconcile initially. But at the end of the day, you know, sort of a large part of it was for my own self-preservation and knowing that, you know, I can do what I, you know, I am trying to do what I can with my little piece of the world and try to make an impact in ways that I can and give back in other ways. But again, there's not a perfect answer for this. I mean, I think, you know, I still 3 years in, I mean, we struggle with it. I practiced menopause medicine for almost 7 years within an insurance-based model of care. And I was very, very lucky to be part of a very large OBGYN office that didn't give me crap for my numbers being not great because I only saw menopause patients. You know, they sort of knew that they wanted that within their practice. And there were a lot of concessions that were made for my billables. That's kind of the hard truth of it, right? Is that, you know, the other nurse practitioners were more productive than me. They brought in more money to the clinic. And that's probably why, you know, a lot of individuals that are still working within the insurance-based model are not sort of, we're moving outside of it if that's our only focus, because it's just, again, it's a very labor intensive. It takes a lot of time to sit down with somebody and really get into the nitty gritty of menopause. And then, you know, if you're not, as our good friend Corinne Men says, if you're not a menopause Barbie and you don't, you know, you don't respond to the standard doses of hormones, to the, you know, you're not a patch princess who gets the middle of the road dose and takes the normal dose of micronized progesterone and it's all sunshine and rainbows, you know, that's fantastic. That can be very easily managed within a 15-minute visit, but not all of us are like that. And so there's just a lot of layers, but I love being an entrepreneur. I love, you know, doing things by my own vein, and I love showing my daughters, you know, they're always griping, "Mommy, you work so much. Or, you know, the year that they told me that I should be a computer for Halloween really hit close to home. But, you know, my mom was an entrepreneur in her own right and really, you know, built herself up in a very male dominated world. And you know, she's not a physician. She's a laboratory and she's an embryologist. And so she really, you know, seeing that really, really inspired me and motivated me to be like, okay, we can do this. Do we have it all? No. Do I do it all right? No. But I try to do the best I can and make the world a better place than, you know, it was before I got there. So
now I agree with you, like, and you know, I just converted my practice after a decade of working with an insurance-based system. And the only, and you know this, and most of my listeners should as well, that the only reason I could do that is because my husband supported my practice. Mm-hmm. And he said, last year, he said, you know, your nonprofit needs to make profit.
Yeah.
Like, I can't support. Sure. I can't be one that sees 45 patients or 50 patients in a day, you know, and continue the way I'm going. And also, as I entered perimenopause in the last few years, what I realized, as you talked about being empaths, like I would come home, you know, maybe, you know, I didn't see 30 patients a day. I saw 15 or whatever, and three or four new patients. And you come home depleted after hearing their stories of, you know, medical gaslighting or, you know, persistent genital pain and all these stuff. And I'd come home really depleted emotionally. And my kids and my husband were like, "What's wrong?" And I'm just like, I can't talk right now.
Right.
Because it does absorb it all, right?
Like you absorb it all 100%. And it takes, it's like you ran, you know, 15 marathons and in one mental marathons in one day, because not only do we as clinicians have to listen to that, and we want to, but we have to internalize it. And then we actually have to decide and make, you know, clinical judgments in terms of what would be the best. So right. And I'm not complaining as a fan. I mean, we're so privileged to be able to do this, but yeah, I know my husband's always like, what's up? How's your day, honey? I'm like, don't talk to me.
Yes. I'm always like this. Like,
oh. Just sit there quietly next to me and breathe the same air, you know, but again, it's a very, this is a very rewarding space in medicine because you can make such a huge impact on individuals, you know, that are really feeling terrible. And it's why it's addicting. It's a fun space to be in when you're in it. When you see those, they're like instant you know, almost like instant gratification moments too.
It's true, actually. Yeah. And I think that's kind of why we all have gelled together in this as well. You know, the ones that we text each other every day.
Yes.
XY.
Yes. 100%. I know. I'm like, some of my, like, who are my friends now? Yeah. They're all my, like, my Instagram doctor friends that I've met. And I'm like, we all just do, you know, we have common interests, common things. So yes, that's my life now. Right. I love it.
I actually wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, your thoughts on, you know, because everyone wants to get their hormones checked. And
yeah,
you know, I'm on a lot of OBGYN threads. And, you know, that's like the bane of most busy OBGYN practices, yeah. Right? They're like, here I get another request to get my hormones checked. And I think you probably do it similar to me, you know, explaining to patients, you know, what the benefit is and then do it because they want to see it, and mine too. But let's talk about.
Oh, yeah. No, you know, this is one of my favorite questions. So, I'll make it really simple and easy. If you're on a hormonal birth control pill, you cannot check your hormones. You cannot accurately assess your hormones. So that's out already. Then if you're in perimenopause and you're having regular menstrual cycles, frequently, you know, within reason, like every 21 to 35 days you're having a period, don't check your hormones, because, or if you check your hormones, you need to check them every single day. And then you need to understand what that means, like the clinical meaning of that when you plot it on a graph. And then superimpose it over like the menstrual cycle graph that we all learned about, right? In school, right? Because if you just go to your gynecologist on a Monday and say, I want to get my hormones checked, and you're having regular menstrual cycles, then it's just going to be whatever that is that day. It's not clinically meaningful or significant. If you are somebody that is experiencing large fluctuations or gaps in your menstrual cycle, or things are just awry, there probably is some utility in perhaps checking a hormone level. If this has been going on for an extended period of time, there can be some potential validation in that, right? So if it's been 3 to 6 months without a period, then maybe I'm going to be checking something called an FSH to see if it's just kind of popping up. And, you know, am I going to necessarily as a clinician act on that or change my treatment plan? Probably not. But as somebody that's living this lived experience, and, you know, not knowing what the hell is going on in my body, I'm going in and getting that, it may be really validating for me to see that level on a piece of paper. So I kind of split the difference. Again, Samina, both you and I work outside of the insurance-based model of care. We've got the time to sit and talk through these options with our patients. So if you're in perimenopause, I would say the vast majority of time, I would recommend steering away from hormones, checking your hormones, because it's just, you're just shooting at fish in a barrel, really. You know, and you're just, it's a moving target. But if things are really spacing out, you're really skipping your periods and you're getting lapses, maybe we can check some hormone levels to add some validity to, you know, if that's something that you want. That's a shared decision making, right? But no, it's very uncommon for insurance companies to also pay for these tests. So you have to be on the lookout for, you know, potentially footing that bill as the patient. And then, So that's my long and short. If you're on birth control pills, don't do it. If you're in perimenopause and having normal menstrual cycles, don't do it unless you're going to do it every single day. And then that's meaningful to you. And if you're in perimenopause and you're really having gaps, then perhaps a test might be helpful for you, not necessarily for your clinician. Right. Does that make sense?
And then
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And then you have those clinical scenarios that we always talk about, like, someone has a marine IUD and we don't know what's happening with their cycle, or someone who's had a history.
Right. No. And yeah, if you have a marine IUD and you really think things are wonky weird, then yeah, why not?
Yeah.
Me getting a blood level is no sweat off my back.
Right.
I mean, again, it's there's all different arguments of that. Now, and people are going to ask, well, what about the Dutch test? What about the urine, you know, test, all the things? And, you know, here's my take on that. To each his own. If you are a naturopathic girly and you want to get your urine hormones tested and you want to see the way that your body is changing all your hormones through the thing, and that's you, great. Do I do urine Dutch tests in my clinic? Absolutely not. I don't run them. I don't use them. Do I have colleagues that do and swear by them? And yes, and I can respect it. Although I feel like there's very little evidence behind them. Will they in 10 years when maybe we get more precision medicine models and we can see it? Maybe. But right now it's just not something that I utilize in my practice. For me, it just overcomplicates things.
Yeah, I agree. And I agree. There's not enough evidence to support it at this juncture. So I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
And looking past sort of like, you know, your menstrual cycle and like reproductive, let's talk a little bit about metabolic changes that happen, because we talked about weight gain being one of the biggest things we hear about.
Yeah.
Let's talk now. And that's why we try, you know, we all met this weekend to kind of like, okay, we don't need to call these things sex hormones anymore because we know they're neuroendocrine metabolic hormones.
Yeah, they function in every tissue in the body, there's so much more than just your reproductive organs, for sure. So yeah, the metabolic changes associated with perimenopause. And the thing that we have to understand, and the thing that we're not maybe the best about in current medical like the way that the culture is in medicine, is we're a little bit more reactionary than we are preventative. As much as we want to say, oh, we have preventative medicine models, we just aren't. And I think it's just because time and we're pinched, right? And we can't. And so here's my take on this. We really need to shift our focus in perimenopause and stop telling women they're too young for perimenopause and stop, you know, brushing them off, because all of the accelerations in our physiology for sort of the negative happen in perimenopause.
Yeah.
They tend to actually settle down a little bit once we've crossed over into menopause, but it's actually perimenopause where we're seeing this acceleration. Mm-hmm. And so what happens, and oftentimes what I'll hear in my practice is a patient say, okay, I went to my primary care doctor and my cholesterol panel for the first time ever in my life went up. Or my hemoglobin A1C, which is an average calculation of your blood sugars over the last 3 months, is up. Or my fasting blood sugar is up.
Mm-hmm.
My liver enzymes are up. You know, none of these have ever been abnormal in my life, and this is up. And so what's happening is
my exercise, none of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Everything's the same, right? You know, doing everything the same and things are changing. So what we see is a rapid acceleration in the perimenopausal years, usually the late perimenopausal years. So that's where we get insulin resistance, metabolic dysfunction, a change in the way our body is processing and metabolizing energy, largely because we see estrogen's light dimming. And estrogen plays a massive role in the function of our pancreas and how insulin is accessed by our cells. And so we see that. We see changes in the thickness of our arteries. We see changes in the cholesterol levels. And so if you're a woman listening to this and you're like, yeah, I mean, my cholesterol shot up 20 points for no reason, you're not, you know, you're not crazy. You're not doing anything wrong. It's literally your body is having changes. The good news is that this does tend to settle down a little bit as we, like I said, as we get into menopause. But unfortunately, then the aging process takes over and then we start just, you know, moving into these chronic diseases. So I think it's really important for us not to have sort of, not to be alarmist about this, but sort of just be smart about it and know that, okay, this is the time where these things are really starting to rev up. And we are oftentimes going to have to be a little bit more proactive and kind of notice this and make some changes, because this is what's happening. And sometimes that will equate about, I think the rate the data says, I mean, like 5 to 10 pounds of true weight gain. Of course, everybody's different. I have some women that have gained way more than that, and some women that slide through with no weight gain. But I think on average, it's about 5 to 10 pounds of weight. And so I think, you know, this is why we're seeing all this, the talk about weight bearing exercises and how do we, you know, walking 7,000 steps a day, you know, trying to meet all these minimums so that we can keep up with these metabolic slowdowns that are really happening.
That and our bone density and muscle mass. Yeah.
Right. Right. And so we're, you know, much of the bone that we are losing as the accelerations is also happening.
Yay.
In perimenopause. thanks to this, you know, yay, right. But, you know, it's not all hope is lost. You know, that's the thing. It's like, we want to put a positive spin on everything. It's like, I think, you know, one thing I will say is as soon as you are, and this might not resonate for everybody, Smita, I know you're a dry girly, but for me who love their red wine, for me, it's like, as soon as you recognize that your body can't process alcohol like it used to, that's when you know, for me, that's what resonates, you know, with me, because I like my glass of wine. Yeah. For you, it probably be something else. But a lot of women will recognize like, oh my God, I can't process alcohol like I used to. It feels awful. And that's a warning sign. Like that's happening metabolically all throughout your body.
The red wine sign. You should call it the red wine sign.
Yeah. 100. I should. Maybe I should coin that. That's how I'm going to get rich, Smita. No, but I think, you know, us just recognizing it. And then what are like little shifts we can do? I mean, we don't necessarily have to do anything massive, but what are little shifts that we can do to start kind of adding ourselves to the list, our list of important things that we need to get done? Because again, this is another problem about this time in our lives is oftentimes we're busy trying to solve everybody else's problems, right? We're dealing with the kids' problems, the husband's problems, the parents' problems, our work, you know, loads. And oftentimes we forget that we also need that time and attention as well. Yeah. So
it's so true, because the patients are often look at me like, oh God, you're giving me so much to do now. I'm sorry.
It is. But you know what? A little shift in the change from instead of parking in the front of the Target parking lot, if you go park in the back of the Target parking lot, like little minimal changes like that. Take, you know, if you work on the third floor of a building, take the stairs, not the elevator, you know. Just stupid little changes. Get as soon as you pull into the driveway when you get home, take 20 minutes, grab your phone and earbuds and go on a power walk. I don't care. Nobody's allowed to talk to you. That's your time. It doesn't have to be these massive muscle movements in order to make good, positive changes in your life that are actually going to, you know, lead to these positive changes. So if it feels insurmountable, try to, it's like, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. So just do little things that you can stomach until maybe you're able to carve more time.
That's great. I love that, actually, because I think that's one of the biggest complaint steps, you know, after the end. They're like, oh, wow, so I have to do what? And it's like, you know, just do what you can. You know, we have to give ourselves grace too.
100%. Some people are all or nothing, and they really need sort of that tough love of like, they're going to change everything overnight. But I think for the vast majority of us, we need simple, relatable, digestible things that we can actually, you know, actionable items that we can actually put into practice. I think that's, you know, honestly, Smita, that is why the weighted vest has taken by storm. I mean, every time I go drive in my neighborhood, there's three or four women out there walking with their weighted vest, because it's a simple, easily attainable thing that they could add in to their day to day without, you know, massive changes. And they can just, you know, do maybe what they were already doing, or at, you know, it's a fun new toy.